The Tea Stop In podcast series is inspired by the memory of the last surviving founder of the Australian Cinematographers Society, my friend, the late John Leake ACS. When he and his wife Marion retired from the film industry, they bought a little motel outside Sydney, and it became a tradition for cinematographers and other filmmakers to stop in and have relaxed conversations about the industry and the craft of cinematography. It earned the nickname of the Tea Stop In. This series sets out to recapture the spirit of those conversations. But this time, we're inviting you to listen in.
The Tea Stop In.
Hi everyone, and welcome to the Tea Stop In. Ben Allen here, and today I'm speaking with Mark Bliss from his home in Prague. G'day, Mark.
Hi Ben, how are you?
Good, good. Thank you for making time. Now,
pleasure.
One of the things that I find amazing is how everybody I've ever spoken to about their story of how they came to be working in the film industry, particularly cinematographers, I've never heard a boring story yet. But I think your background is one of the best that I've come across. Tell us your story.
It is indeed. And to start, it's like... From a very early age, I was into literature, books, and cinema. I would not miss a single screening of anything that was on in our little town. I grew up in a small town in southeast Bohemia, and
so literally, you know, Bohemian.
Bohemian, indeed, yes, and. At the time, I was a kid. I just loved seeing movies, and westerns was probably the most enjoyable genre for us at the time, because we would then reenact all the scenes from the movies with my friends in the surrounding forests and lakes. And but little did I know that I was growing up in a communist Czechoslovakia at the time. And by the time I was, 12, 13, I gathered that not all is well with this state, and I discovered my father's highly illegal library, which gave me even more insight into the workings of the regime. And from the age of about 16, I was planning how to escape, from all the books and all that, I've read, all Jules Verne and travel books and adventure books. I always wanted to see the world. And when I realized that living in a communist country doesn't really help, us the citizens were not allowed to travel, basically. I did not know anyone in my close proximity that would actually have a passport or been anywhere. So I wanted to be an artist. I wanted to go and study painting and drawing, because my painting and drawing skills were quite good at the time at school. All my works were sort of hanging on the walls and whatnot. But because of my father's political background, I was not allowed to join any art schools. And that was very heartbreaking for me at the time. I was maybe 14. My mother came home one day and she had a newspaper clipping. And it said, "Do you want to become a sailor?" And there was a quiet moment. And I go, "Well, how can I become a sailor if we don't have any seas? You know, the country is seriously landlocked." And so I read on, and I realized that we actually indeed did have merchant navy. And this ad was looking for basically 14, 15-year-old boys that would join up and go study at a merchant school or merchant sailor school, and which I did. I sort of put my hand up and sat down for the entry exams, went through my medicals like a really military style, sort of 3 days in a hospital being checked thoroughly for by all the doctors, and obviously passed with flying colors, and ended up in sort of Navy high school, which I completed in 1982. And I remember in the final year, a friend of mine gave me a copy of George Orwell's 1984, which was, at the time, it was a banned book. You were not, you know, that wow. was basically being in possession of that book would earn you several years in prison. And so the copy that I got was a hand-typed copy. Someone, to disseminate the book, someone retyped the entire book. And my copy was the last legible copy. So it was like the seventh or wow. eighth carbon copy. And it was typed on this, a very light paper, like a cigarette style paper. So it was so fragile. It was barely legible. And he gave it to me and says, and I said, well, what is this? And he goes, so I opened it up. And from the first line, I knew it was 1984. And he says, you got 3 days to read it because it's on a loan. Wow. And it was all very underground. And it was all, he says, you have to read it in 3 days. No one can see you read this book. And, you know, you have to give it to Meg. And, you know, not a word. Yeah. So I covered the book in a newspaper and read it while walking home, and then got on a train and read it all the way to Bratislava, which is now the capital of Slovakia, where I was studying at the time. It was minus 20 outside, and the train was completely frozen and the windows were frozen. And I was sitting in the compartment reading 1984, and I was looking at the other people in the compartment. I was going, he's a secret policeman. He's a collaborant. And so I was like, I was petrified reading this book. And I think it was either 1982 or 1983. And I was reading 1984. And the future looked definitely very bleak. And so by the time we arrived in Bratislava, I finished reading the book. And as I got off the station, there was this massive banner in red that says, "The Soviet Union Forever." And I was going, I have to get out of here.
Wow.
And so it took me further 5 years to actually make good and escape, which wasn't easy because there's no 101s to escaping at the local library, and no one can tell you how to escape. And obviously you don't want to, you know, there's no rehearsals. If they catch you while trying to cross the borders, you'd be done for, you know, some serious amount of time, 10, 15, 20 years. God knows they would, you know, fabricate whatever, and they would put you into a slammer for a very long time. But I made it through the borders. And
so how did that happen?
Whoa, how long do we have? So I finished the Navy training. At the time, I was already, I had my certificate, and I started to be a ship engine mechanic, basically, at the time. And I couldn't care less what I was doing on the ship as long as I got out of the country. And in 83, when I finished, I joined my first ship. And funnily enough, it was in Soviet Union. I went to, at the time it was called Leningrad, now it's St. Petersburg.
Yeah.
And got onto the largest ship we had at the time. It was the MS Vitkovice, which was 45,000 tons of, so it was 214 meters long, 37 meters wide, and it was... I mean, for a young lad that never seen a proper ship, this was just like, you know, I was standing there, and it was actually empty, so it was like, you know, massive. It was massive, wow. And I've spent I think 9 months on that ship, crisscrossed the entire world, went to Canada, Brazil, Africa, a lot of Europe, and it was. I mean, I was 18, 19 at the time, or 10, 19 on the ship. It was incredible for someone so young to be actually seeing
the world.
The world at the time, where and it was a much slower world at the time because there was no internet, there was no
No Google, no email.
There was nothing. So, and the boat was chugging at some, slow speeds across the Atlantic. And if you've seen Perfect Storm with George Clooney, so my first trip was crossing the Northern Atlantic, the Northern Way. We've actually seen those fishermen out there fishing. Wow. And it was now you see me and now you don't, because they would disappear behind these massive waves.
Wow.
That you just go, hang on, there was a fishing boat, and then you get your binoculars and you go, there's people on the deck and they are working, and we were not allowed to go on deck because the waves were just going, right over the boat.
Yeah.
And it was huge. But backpedal to my escaping, I was after I came back from my first trip on the ship, I got called into the army, and it was compulsory, so there was no two ways about it. And the army was basically my there was the proverbial last drop into the cup of bitterness, because I realized what the regime was about, the indoctrination, the hazing of the young soldiers was unbelievable. Wow. And so I've decided that, I thought about it before, on the first trip, but back then I was madly in love with my girlfriend at the time, and I could not see escaping, could not see myself escaping or staying in somewhere without, my girlfriend. So, who is now my wife, by the way.
Wow. So that worked out.
it worked out. It was worth coming back for, yeah. So, but the 2 years of the military service definitely, tipped
made
me.
Made your mind up.
Made my mind up. I said, I have to get out of here. And but also what happened was during my Navy services, also the military services, I became a projectionist.
Wow.
On the boat, at the time there was no DVD, VHS neither. The only way of entertainment was to have a projector. And I would be always in the cinema. And so when the projectionist was leaving the ship, he says, Mark, listen, you're always here. Every single projection I do, you're always here. Might as well. I'll teach you how to be a projectionist.
Wow.
So he taught me. And I jokingly always claim that was my first film school, because, we would have maybe 15, 20 films for the entire journey. So, half, 5-6 months into the trip, you would have seen all the movies 20, 30 times.
So you'd analyze them. You'd become familiar with every detail.
Yes. And it was very subconscious. I would sit in the projection booth and I would turn down the audio for myself.
Wow. And which is such a great way to learn about a film, is just analyze it without the sound.
And especially if you've seen it 15, 20 times.
Yeah, yeah.
You sort of subconsciously learn about editing. You subconsciously learn about lenses and light. The atmosphere that you see, suddenly go, okay, well, and then, and being able to see it, it really was 15, 20 times easy, each film.
Yeah.
I mean, in the end, some of them were fairly boring. So what the sailors would do, they would write an alternative script and they would come in with their props and they would sit in the cinema and I go, Mark, okay, you put on such and such a movie with no audio. And they would read up the entire film into some, slapstick black comedy. They would have their little instruments. They would bring buckets with water and make splashing sounds to make a folly sound. And it was hilarious.
That's
and of course,
fantastic.
Being on a boat, there was always some alcohol involved. And you could see the sailors on the deck rehearsing all day long. They would just enact out a certain scene. So So that was my first film school. And then I became a projectionist also in the army. So I spent extra 2 years as a projectionist. And then when I finally left the army, I knew that, you know, I wasn't staying. And so in July 87, I got called to join a ship in former what used to be Yugoslavia, and they sent me by train by myself, which was very unusual, because normally we would travel in a group by bus through, you know, other communist countries, and then this time they sent me by myself on a train through Austria. So the minute I was in Vienna, I just got off the train and just handed myself in at a police station and said, I'm a refugee and I'm claiming a political asylum, and, you know, please do not send me back.
So somehow from there you made your way to Australia. How did that happen?
At the time there was three places that would take migrants. It was the United States, Canada and Australia. Wow. And Australia was at the time was the hardest to qualify for, because the there was a point system that you had to accumulate certain amount of points to be able to be eligible. And I was fairly paranoid at the time. I wanted to get as far away from the communist Czechoslovakia at the time as possible. And by my reckoning, Australia was the furthest.
Far as you could get.
So I did go for an interview, which to this day, I think it was one of the most pivotal days in my life.
Yeah.
Because interestingly enough, your future life or your entire life hangs on this one interview. And it's like you're going for a job that you really, really want, but this is times 1,000 or something. Yeah. This is your next future life will be decided.
It's hard to imagine if you haven't been through that, just how extreme that must be.
So I did not sleep the night before, of course, because my brain was going nuts.
Wow.
But I think I got 86 points out of 100, and 80 was the minimum.
Wow.
So I got in, and it was, you know, I mean, and apart from my children being born, I still recount this as being the happiest day of my life. So, I mean, the feeling of elation was unbelievable. It was really, I was so coming to Australia, I realized that I had an amazing chance that hardly anyone ever gets, is that I can start anew.
Mm.
And everything that I achieve from now on is going to be only to my efforts. It's only going to be what I set myself to.
You've got a clean sheet of paper.
Absolutely. Clean slate. You know, it's like in a movie, slate one, take one.
Wow.
This is up to you, Mark. So what would you like to do? And I said, I want to be a filmmaker. I had no idea what it actually means, because at the time I just loved movies and I wanted to get
deeper into that.
Yes. And so I've searched. There was no online at the time, so getting information was tricky, but I found out that there was two places in Australia that would teach filmmaking. It was AFTERS and also the North Sydney Technical College.
Yeah.
And
both famous courses.
I went to sit for an entry exam for North Sydney TAFE, but my English at the time was virtually non-existent. I mean, I could ask where the railway station was, but that was much about it. So to my disappointment, I could not understand some of the questions at the entry exam. So it meant that I had to just eat a bit of a humble pie and went back for a year, studied English intensively. I had three courses. I had like a morning, an afternoon, and an evening course. Wow. For the first 6 months I was in Australia. And then the following year I went back again, got in, and studied cinematography. I did the 4-year course. The first year was kind of, you know, general knowledge. Mm-hmm. And you do anything and everything. You do sound, you do editing, you do directing, and you do cinematography. But by the time we finished the first year, I knew I wanted to be behind camera. And so basically second year, I went and was specializing in cinematography. And I was so very fortunate that I had Terry Bennett, ACS, as my teacher. I mean, at the time, we did not know. We were like, you know, I was so young. And so we did not know who Terry was. It was some old geezer teaching us, you know, and we were fairly hungry for knowledge. So, and it was brilliant. You know, we learned everything from animation to, you know, all the different styles in, you know, high key, low key. Mm. And
were you shooting film?
We were shooting film. Luckily enough, Terry, being a former GOP himself, had a really great contacts next door at the ABC.
Ah.
And so every night he would walk into the classroom and he would carry a pile of short ends.
Wow.
of 16 millimeter reversal stock. Wow. And if you've ever shot reversal stock, you'd know how unforgiving that
and which is a great way to learn.
Well, you know,
if you made a mistake, you would know about it. Yeah, straight away.
Yes, you would certainly do. And Terry, I remember the first, and it must have been like our second week of the course, and Terry would give us wind-up bell and howls.
Yeah.
Or there was also the Russian wind-up camera. I think it was called Krasnodorsk or this. And also we had the Canon Scupic.
Yep, wow.
And he would hand these cameras out, and he would give us 100 feet of reversal color stock, and he goes, okay, you go to the railway station, you go to Circle Key, you go to the airport. That was at a time where you could still just enter the airport and film. And then he'd send us, and you go into the, you know, you go down to the Bermond fishing, and he goes, you come back with a story.
An amazing way to teach.
Yeah.
To have those limitations and go tell a story.
And obviously all the editing was to be done in camera.
Yep.
And so I remember I got, I think it was the railway station that I got. So I arrived at Central. And so first what you do, you just walk around and you go, okay, well, here's a shot and this could look interesting. And he says, but I don't want to, and Dave would say, I don't want just, you know, images. He says, I want a story.
Yeah.
And so that made you think. And a lot of the times we would return back and there'd be nothing on the film because we would shoot with the bell and howl. And a lot of people just would not take the landscape off because they'd be looking through the...
Yeah, they wouldn't know.
Through the viewing lens. Or if they took off the landscape, they would not focus, they forget to focus, or they didn't set the stop right. Yeah. And what we did with Terry, he would have the films developed at the ABC lab, and then we would put it on a projector and we would screen them. So you'd see your work, not on a monitor somewhere, on a steam bag, but you'd see it projected. And that in itself was amazing because the mistakes that you made were much bigger.
But that must have been an amazing experience for you after all those years as a projectionist to finally see your own work, your own creation of images up there on a big screen.
It was unbelievable. I remember one of the very first exercises we did was a low-key lighting. And a friend of mine had a colleague at work who was a dead ringer for Gene Hackman. And I kid you not, he had the moustache, he had the body language, because he knew. Wow. If we look, it was a dead ringer for Gene Hackman. And I'm so sorry I don't have that piece of film. So what we did, at the studios at the North Sydney College, we built a simple set, Venetian blinds, got some props and, filing cabinets. And we gave him a fedora hat and we made him into a Detective Marlowe type, seat on the table, a spinning fan and a cigar. And I had 100 feet of film. So the entire story was basically storyboarded. And we knew that we need to get, 15 seconds of this shot. And then we need to do over the shoulder and do a 3-second insert on that. And then just come back and do a. And so we shot it in a fairly much, with a tiniest of crew, maybe 5 other students. And so when the entire class came for the projection, everyone was like, that's Gene Hackman. I mean, he was in Sydney shooting some big American flick, so we asked him to. And for a long time, they could not figure out how we came clean later on, but it was a friend of a friend, basically.
So you had this amazing kind of grounding in the craft there. How did that translate to getting out into the real working world?
Little did I know about the 10BA. I finished the film school in 1992.
Yeah.
93, I think. Yes. Yeah, 93. We kind of made a small revolution at North Sydney TAFE because we started to shoot short films, which was not done at the time there. They would shoot all the exercises, low key, high key, this, that. But none of it was narrative. And I said, well, can we do that? Can we? And they said, well, why not? So by the time we were in our final year, we'd be shooting short films, 10, 15 minute short films. And as I was always behind the camera, a lot of the other guys asked me to DOP their short films, which was quite amazing. I thought, okay, brilliant.
Yep.
And so after graduation, I was like, I'm a DOP.
Yeah.
And little did I know that 10BA just went belly up. There was an army of DOPs with extensive credits, their own equipment and lenses and cameras. And so I came into realizing that it's going to be probably much, much harder than I thought. And it was. I mean, it was, and I guess it's that's where you learn. And I started to shoot music videos, corporate films, small documentaries. You name it, anything that came my way. I did a lot of music videos at the beginning. We had an RESD that would run out of sync after 30, 40 seconds. So the music videos that we shot would the takes were limited to like 30 seconds because we knew that after the 30 seconds because the motor wasn't crystal synced, so it was this sort of it's like okay, it's put it here. It's going to be 25, but it wasn't. So
so it's just, and but it's knowing what you can get away with.
Yes. And obviously there was no budgets, and the ideas was fairly basic, but just being able to put a film into a camera, run around Sydney and do the things that we've done, which probably now we'd end up in a police cell for it. I remember we closed the Harbour Bridge for one of these little short films where we got, it was very early in the morning in summer, so the light was maybe 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning. It would be probably enough light to film. So we got about 7 or 8 production cars, and we blocked all the ball crews. And so only the camera and the actor would drive up. And we drove up to the middle of the Harbour Bridge. Wow. The actor would jump out. I had the camera on a hi-hat. He would run into the middle of the road, lie down, and I'd just film him. And then we just jumped in Maybe it would have taken 40, 50 seconds maybe. We jumped in and drove on and just and I think we must have had walkie-talkies. So yeah. I think we just let the guys – because they were pretending they're fumbling for money and couldn't find it. So just held the toll booths and the traffic for long enough so we could get this shot. And
The number of layers of things in that story that would just could never happen today is toll booths themselves don't exist anymore. All electronic.
Yeah. So it was hilarious. It was just, but you know, we said, well, how are we going to do this? He says, well, we need to have these dead people all around. We actually shot some dead people on the steps of the Opera House as well. Same deal. It was like a flash mob. We got maybe 50, 60 extras, and very, very, very early in the morning, like dawn, and we had them walk up to the Opera House on the steps and set the angle. And it was just one shot. It was just one shot. I go, okay, now. And everyone just lay down on the steps of the Opera House. I have no idea what happened to that short film or where did it end up, but there's some 16mm celluloid lying around with these type of images on it. So.
Amazing.
But every time, I think already when I was at North Sydney Tech, I joined the ACS. And I would religiously attend all the screenings and... anything they would put up. I remember we'd go to Cinema Australia and
wasn't that amazing? That beautiful theatre.
It was just the best thing ever.
Yeah.
And knowing that all those DOPs that I've only seen in the Australian Cinematographers magazine were there and chatting, and they were all fairly laid back because they knew each other and you know. I was a kid from somewhere else, so I was a bit shy. So,
but they were all so accessible and so open their knowledge, and you know, it was a really. I mean, I came into that about 96, 97, and you know, it was an amazing experience. Just this kind of wider world of people who were offshooting big films and doing amazing work and talking about really high standards. And it was very inspiring.
I remember having been there for Dean Semler's Dances with Wolves. And you had Dean on the T-Stop in some time ago. And I remember it was so, I mean, I was like a kid in the candy store because, you know, one of your heroes, it's just meters away from you, and Dean being Dean, he was so jovial and you know so accessible, and you know, and some of the stories, of course, from you know behind the scenes, and then having the film introduced by him and being sitting in the audience, knowing that he's there, it was magic. It was magic, mm-hmm. And it is so inspiring as well. And you know, I would drag half of my class with me because of some guys, you know, this is unbelievable. And it certainly was.
I think there was also an element of, you know, when they're there in the room with you, when you're watching this film, that's all these iconic films and you go, wow, these real human beings made this bit of magic.
Yeah. And then years later, learning about Dean's background also gives you this, you know, this boost of confidence that you go, okay, listen to his story or Don McAlpine's story is even crazier. Yeah. So so you go, it's possible. There's no one way.
No.
So I remember going to any of the ACS presentation meetings or screenings was just fantastic, and it's so inspiring. And then it was the first year after I came out of film school, teamed up with this young director choreographer, and we made this short film, which was very poetic. It was a very loose. There was not a very narrative structure. It was like a poem. Wow. And it was basically the story of you mourning someone who died, and we And I was so fortunate to actually meet up with her. And we met this short film called Morning Hours, where we did some underwater footage, and it was all very visual. The rain was representing the tears that she couldn't shed. And it was so I did a lot of trick shots in this film where I would have the rain falling all the way through behind her, but because there was no light on her, on the rain, you couldn't see it. And at one point, we would just throw a flick, and suddenly everything behind her was just full of rain.
Amazing.
And we did some underwater footage where it's like at the time, it's like we can't get underwater. Casing had no money, and I don't think it actually existed for 16 mil cameras. Maybe it did. I acquired a large fish tank, weighed it down with lots of sandbags, put the camera, and I was in the RESD, I think, or no, RESR2.
Wow.
And we submerged it. So the lens was just below the water surface.
Yeah.
And I had maybe about 5 centimeters extra glass on top. I said, guys, just no waves. And because we wanted to, and we had no underwater lights. And so what we did, we had this large outdoor pool. Mm. And we covered the entire pool with black plastic and just left maybe a meter gap. And we shot it at, about 2 or 3 p.m. So we had the hard sun coming in, but it was just a shaft of light.
Wow.
And behind and foreground, it was just pitch black.
Wow.
And it looked magical. And so the film, when it was finished, cut, edited, everything, I put it up for the ACS Awards. And I remember we won silver ACS. And for me, it was just... I was out, and it was my, I this think it was my first, it. Yeah, yeah. And I thought, okay, this is amazing. and I remember it very clearly because at the time I didn't own a suit. So a friend of mine lent me a suit and you there with all these other people, they're getting the awards for, the best feature films. And I think this was in 93 or 94. It was like the year I came out of film school, basically.
Wow.
And so it was quite amazing. It was, I thought, okay, I'm enjoying this. I want more of this. So. but then came the realization that, I would be shooting a lot, but a lot of it was for free.
Yeah.
And there was very few paying jobs and I was sort of tried to focus pool for other people. But as I said, it was after 10 BA and there was an army of people with much better content. Yeah.
More people than work.
Yeah, and so it was fairly tough. It was fairly hard the first few years, the initial years. And
because the Australian industry has gone through these waves, these ups and downs, and it's in a bit of a boom period with international work, particularly at the moment. But I think it's very easy for people to lose sight of how quickly those can turn. And 10BA was a big wave of local production. And then that disappeared for a long time, and there was no international production coming in as well in that period, and so those waves can come and go, and it's really quite shocking how dramatic they can be.
And indeed, and it was for me the realizing that it's not going to be that easy to earn your crust as a DOP. Obviously, I would I would have part-time jobs. I'd do anything and everything I could earn my rent, and I would send out CVs, and I would go and talk to production houses, and it wasn't easy. It was fairly hard. And I would shoot music videos. I shoot 2 music videos for Midnight Oil, and I was sort of alternating between. Focus pulling for some people, but definitely trying to shoot as well, which wasn't the best you can't sit on 2 chairs basically. So in the end, I decided that, okay, I'm going to be a DOP and that's it. And that was very, very ballsy of me. But
so when do you feel like you got through that phase of your career?
It was taking a very long time. But I think in 1996, I got my first break on a feature film. I used to shoot low-budget commercials for Fontana films. Wow. And I remember they were notorious with their payment schedules. And I remember going there once to inquire about my, you know, where's my check kind of thing. And in the corridor, I bumped into one of the producers and he goes, do you want to shoot a feature film? And I thought he was joking. I said, yeah, of course, yeah. He goes, oh, come with me, I'll give you the script, yeah.
Wow.
And sure enough, he just walks into an office, you know, grabs a script, gives it to me, and goes, read it and tell me what you think. And I read it, and it was a B-grade movie. I go, I want to shoot it. He said, okay, come in next week for an interview.
Yeah.
And I'm going, it doesn't happen this way, does it? And so I drive in and I walk into a room and there's this big guy, Joe Tornatore. And he is some distant cousin of Giuseppe Tornatore who made Il Postino. Cinema Paradiso. And I did not know. And he goes, he's sitting there, goes, hi, you know, I've seen your work and I really like it, kid. And I have to warn you, I shoot fast. To which I had nothing better to reply than, I shoot faster. And he goes, you are hired.
That's brilliant.
That was it. And I go, hang on, didn't he just say I was hired? And he goes, yeah, well, you know, he got up and shook my hand and thanks, kid, and this. And sure enough, you know, it was a feature film. It was looking back now, it was a B-grade movie. And
but it was a feature film.
It was a feature film, and we shot it on a 35mm, and it was unbelievable for me. And I was, we had up to 3-4 cameras on some stunt scenes. And it was quite unbelievable. I remember calling Terry Byrne, my teacher, the day before the start of the shoot and saying, Terry, I'm like, you know, I think I'm just way, way over. And he goes, Mark, just relax. You know, it's, you just have to remember BBC. I go, what's BBC? He goes, brightness, background and contrast. Yeah.
That'll do it.
So that'll do it. So I call him before my all of my shoots, and I go, "Terry, how does the BBC goes?" And he just turned 98 years old a couple of weeks ago, and I had a chat to him, and he was an amazing guy, and still he's very much my kind of a guru, I would say.
Gurus and mentors are such a precious thing, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And I wish, I think to have a mentor, and not strictly just in the way of the business or the lighting or the camera, but it's someone that, because it's, you know, you can't go onto a film just, hey, you're a great DOP, but you know nothing about the rest of anything. It's not going to help. So having a mentor is amazing. And Terry's been a mentor for his entire life to me. So I'm eternally grateful for what he put in here. So
that's wonderful. So now you're a feature film DOP.
What
happened next?
And so you're thinking, okay, well, now it's, I've got to get all the offers are going to start coming in. And of course, nothing happens. Yeah. So I got approached by Tim Boyle saying, oh, I want to shoot the Australian version of Evan Smith's Clerks. You know, he was, I go, it's like, what do you mean? He said, I want to shoot an ultra low budget movie, shooting like 12 days, and it's going to be all one location. And I said, okay, right, okay. And at the time, I acquired a 16 millimeter camera at Eckler ACL.
Wow.
An amazing,
beautiful camera.
Beautiful, lovely. The Mac reload would take like 10 seconds, you know, take off, put on, shoot again, yeah. Because the Macs were threaded inside the Mac, same as the Arton afterwards. And I said, okay, and he said, oh, I've got no money. So, okay, you don't have to pay me, but you have to pay for the camera. I goes, oh, yeah, of course, because we need a camera. Yeah? So, so there was very little money. So I made my lighting gear from Chinese lanterns that we bought down in Chinatown. Wow. And I think I heard the largest fixture would have been about 3 feet across. And I put three photo crescendo bulbs in. They were 250 each, so it was a, you know, 750, a soft balloon light.
Lovely.
And I made a spurt around it, like you got now on space lights. I could actually go up and down to control the spread, and I would have a flap on the side, so I could use it as a side light.
So you'd be able to very, very quickly have this beautiful soft wraparound source wherever you needed it.
Then we had a smaller size that was about 2 feet across, and then I would have a really tiny ones which were used as a sort of eye light just behind the camera.
Yeah.
And I would have guys walking with these. I would have them on C-stands, or we would just rig them with clamps anywhere.
Mm.
And they work so, so beautifully. And, you know, we had no Jenny, so the largest light.
Household power.
Yeah, household power. And I think the largest light we had was maybe a Blondie.
So 2,000 watts.
Yeah, that's it. And then you go, okay, well, can I plug anything else in the circuit? No, you can't.
Well, then you have no lights.
I've shot two more feature films back-to-back on the 16 or Super 16 mil because we had the camera converted to Super 16 afterwards. Mm. In quick succession, there was the first one took 13 days to shoot, and it was what it was. It's called Big Night Out. I've never seen a copy of it. I've never seen the film finished.
But it's out there somewhere.
It's out there somewhere. And I've shot another 2-3 films. And I got similarly to my first feature film, I got hired on a German-Australian co-production in Melbourne where, you know, they asked me to fly in for an interview. And so I just had my onboard luggage, you know, and came in and met the German director. At the end of the interview, he says, you know, it's fantastic if we can work with you. I said, yeah, I'd love to come on board. And when do you want me to start? And they go, now. And that's how I called my wife. You know, she said I was going for like an afternoon and I'll be back in the evening for dinner. And I called my wife and I said, well, honey, can you pack my bags and send it to me? And so, at the time I already had my two children. So being a working DOP, as you well know, puts a lot of stress on the family life. Mm-hmm. And they came down to Melbourne and joined me there with my wife and my kids. And and it was a movie about Ivan Milat. This is we're talking maybe 1998, 1999.
Yeah.
So that was very interesting, and really, really enjoyed that. Shortly afterwards, I teamed up with Michael Wong, Australian director, who was a starting commercial director, and we did a couple of jobs together. And I think our third or fourth job won a major award at some London commercial film festival.
Yeah.
To which Michael basically decided that he's moving to Europe because
that's where the opportunities were.
that's his ticket, and he's leaving. I was going, well, okay, well, that's my director going gone.
Because as a cinematographer, once you've developed those kind of relationships with a director, that kind of becomes your meal ticket as well as your creative collaboration.
Absolutely. I had no other director that I was working with on a regular basis in Australia. And he basically said, listen, of course I will try to get you on every job, but I doubt that people will fly you out of Australia. And so it happened. He came over to London, and surely enough, he had a job within a couple of weeks. And he rang me and said, listen, here's the job. Do you want it? I go, yeah. Wow. So I lied through my teeth. I told the production company that I was in Europe on another job, and and they have to fly me from Prague.
Yeah.
So I paid my own ticket to Prague, and they flew me to do the job, and I did it two more times. And after there was it was established that, you know, we worked together, then I said, listen, guys, I'm on a job in Australia. So we'll fly you back. I said, that's it, great. So I would do this for 2 years, but at the end of the 2 years, I have flown the Australia-Europe journey about 22 or 23 times. And if you've done that flight, you know you don't want to be doing that often.
At that point, you're starting to spend more time on the airplane than looking through the viewfinder.
So it was, and family life, you know, my kids were very young at the time, and I was going, well, I need to spend more time with the kids. So I proposed to my wife that we move to Europe for 1 year. You know, it'd be great for the kids, see Europe, you know, be in a different environment, and we'll see what happens. And this was in 2007. We moved, and we chose Prague because obviously the language wasn't a problem.
Yeah.
3 days after landing, I got a job in New Zealand. So
of course.
So my wife's going, "Are you for real? You know, this is not happening, is it?" So off I flew to New Zealand, and it did pay off in terms of the work. And suddenly, for the first time in my life, I actually felt that I was a working DOP, because the word got out. And I was, honestly, I was going from one job to another with maybe 2 days or 3 days in between commercial jobs. And these were mostly commercial.
Yep.
Some music videos as well. It to start with, it was Prague and Europe, and then I started to go South Africa, and I started to shoot in South America, and then I was shooting in LA and in New York, and so suddenly I was flying all over the place and working with, and interestingly enough, a lot of sort of directors would come and shoot in Prague, because Prague is a big hub for filmmakers. They got amazing studios, amazing technicians and artisans, art directors, prop masters, just stunning. And also the scenery.
And so accessible to London and, you know, the rest of Europe.
So a lot of directors would come in, and they would ask the production house, so do you have any local DOPs that you can offer? And they would go, well, you know, there's Mark as well. So they would look at my reel, and I would do a job with them. And the next thing is they're calling me for a job in Spain or a job in South Africa. So it turned into a 10-year nonstop back-to-back, basically a crazy schedule.
Yeah.
And
which is a double-edged sword, I guess. It's, you know, amazing to be getting all those opportunities, but it would be relentless after a while.
It was, I mean, having the experience from Australia that, like, you know, long times between drinks, I would say yes to it, just everything. About everything.
Yeah.
And then at a certain time I said, okay, I need to start choosing more carefully. And I think it was in 2010, I got approached by Jan Svierak, his producer. And Jan Svierak is the only Czech director who's got two Oscars to his name. He got one as for his student film, a short film. And the second one he got for a best foreign movie. And I would, the name of the movie is Kolya. I would struggle to actually put a name, put a year on when it was, but it was sometimes after the Velvet Revolution, so
yeah,
probably in the 90s. So I got approached by his producer in... And he said, oh, look, and he didn't say who. He said, you know, we're going to shoot this new film and the director would like to meet you and have a chat with you. I go, yeah, sure. So we met up in a bar and there was a producer and we're chatting. I said, okay, and is the director going to join us? He goes, yeah, he'll be here in a moment. So the director arrives and he says, hi, my name is Jan. I said, oh, very nice to meet you. My name is Mark. And so we... talking and talking about the film and the project and the approach. And about 10, 15 minutes into the chat, he goes, you don't know who I am, do you? Your name is Jan. I know you, Jan. And he starts laughing. I says, what's so funny? He says, you don't know who I am. I said, no, you just told me you are Jan. He goes, my name is Jan Swierak. And, you know, my jaw dropped. And of course, I know all his movies. You know, I've seen all his films and I love his work. But, I don't read tabloid newspapers and I don't read celebrity pages. And he's kind of actually a recluse. He doesn't go to these, you know, big gala evenings. And and he was laughing his head off. And so was the producer because they thought, this is hilarious because he kind of, you know, like, it's like everybody knows me here. Yeah. And so, and I thought there was a bit of an icebreaker as well. So, but he had this idea for a feature film with Joyce. And, you know, he shot some tests on a little HD camera, just running around the forest with like some remote controlled cars and stuffed Joyce in it. And he wrote an entire screenplay for it and it was amazing. And he said, but we, you know, because I wanted to go to cinemas, we need to shoot 35 mil. Mm. And I want it to be light, you know, nimble, sort of very easy crew. I go, yeah, let's do that. Within weeks, we realized it's not doable that way. You know, we would come into a forest and you have some beautiful shafts of light coming through. And this is brilliant. We'll have the puppet to come from left to right and he's going to do this scene. And the puppeteers would come in and say, listen, we need half an hour to rig the puppet so it can come from right to left, because at the moment we've got it rigged so it can come from left to right, or it's rigged for, and we, unfortunately it was a fairly low budget production. We only had three versions of the puppet. Normally you'd have, you know, 15, 20, you know, one that could be left from up, one from bottom, one for left, right, one for driving shots, one for, you know, close-ups. And so the schedule went from 30 days to 60 days. And I think I left the shoot at about the 80 day mark. And it was finished by a friend of mine. And I think the final count was like 128 shooting days or something to that amount. And I was contracted already on other shoots and it was like, okay, yeah, I had to leave. The film is quite amazing. It's like Mad Max with puppets, basically. and unfortunately, the hero was about 20 centimeters tall. So it meant that if you wanted to do a shot that actually show some perspective, we would have to dig the cameras in.
Wow.
And a lot of macro photography. But it is quite amazing. It was shot, you know, we shot four seasons. There's some amazing car chase scenes in the snow. There's some of this, you know, wheat fields on fire all the way to the horizon. So it was massive, but it kind of took its toll on everyone because it the shooting schedule just kept on going. When we finished that, I went back to shooting commercial music videos. Mm-hmm. Also did some documentaries as well. I was fairly busy with work, mostly commercial work. But then and this is skipping forward, COVID came.
Yeah.
And at the time, I was working as a second unit DOP on an American TV series, the Wheel of Time, which is this big epic TV series for Amazon. It was unbelievable. I mean, my second unit crew, one day I counted 64 people.
Wow. On second unit.
We had horses, drones. I had two techno cranes.
Just a little shoot.
Yeah. you name it. And it was a very, just a complete step into another world again, being part of something so big and massive. We were going to shoot some scenes away in Slovenia, so we only took the core crew and cast, so there was 500 of us going.
mind-boggling, that scale, yes, isn't it?
Yeah. It's I think that the regular crew in Prague was around 1200 people.
Wow.
And you know, we had several stages. Obviously, COVID threw a big spanner into the works because suddenly your drivers that would normally drive 7-8 people in a van could only carry 2 people because they had made partitions in the car. So also in catering, testing, being tested twice a day.
Everything becomes more complex.
Yeah, and so also the schedule, just we were shooting maybe half the stuff that we would normally shoot. Yeah. So it was fairly hard. And then when COVID hit full, they basically stopped. They stopped the production because it was no longer. We had so many people testing positive on the crew that it just basically there was no crew to be had.
Wasn't possible. So they going.
Yeah. So they call it quits. So suddenly we're all sort of sitting around doing nothing, and all you want to do is be on a set work. And so it was fairly, fairly hard. And then I got a call from Tiago, and Tiago is the director of Restos do Ventu. And he says, "Oh, Mark, do you want to shoot my next feature film?" And I thought he was pulling my leg. And and we've shot things together before, but they were commercial or documentaries. And I said, "Okay, send me the script, please, and let's get the discussion going." And he sent me the script. It turned out to be a fairly deep, dark story. Very something that one would, you know. I mean, I was completely gutted by the end of it, because as I was reading through the script, I was going, please, don't screw up the ending, yeah, because a lot of the times, you know, you read something and it's going well, and then it comes to the ending, and it's that was like so obvious.
Endings are hard.
The endings are extremely hard. I was completely speechless at the end of it. And
wow.
So I rang him up right away, and I said, he goes, "What do you think?" I said, "Well, I think I need a couple of days to actually digest this, because it's of the, you know, the weight of what is being told in this story." I said, "This is not a happy movie." He goes, "No, it's not a happy movie." So we talked about the whys. Why he actually wanted to make this movie, and he's a very introverted person he's a very modest, quiet man that with a sort of deep level of examining things in life, and you know, he's sort of my age or maybe a little bit younger, teenage children that face certain things in life. And he's obviously prompted to write this because of some experiences that he's been retold by his kids. And from the beginning, the discussion wasn't about how to make the movie technically. It was more about how to take what he has written or co-written, because there's two writers on this, and make it as powerful as the written word without making it too beautiful or romantic or so removed from reality that you're actually watching it as a piece of filmmaking, and you kind of can't relate to it because it's so, you know, glossed over or whatever. From the very first discussions, this was very much on our minds, to how to actually grab the subject to make it very definite in terms of so it will work for us. And I've decided, and the film is it plays out in two distinct parts. There's a flashback part to 20 years prior, so say 1990s.
Yeah.
Where this thing happened during a traditional cultural sort of event. They got this sort of pagan tradition that happens. It's like a traditional celebration. Something happens during it. We cut to 25 years later, when all of the participants of this unfortunate things are now adults with children of similar age to what they were when this happened. And it's a small community, so everybody knows of what happened 25 years prior, how they live with the consequences of what happened on that fateful day. So that we wanted to really differentiate these two sections. So we've shot some tests. I did some tests here in Prague, and I would send them to Tiago, who lives in Lisbon. And we kind of arrived at the certain decisions and decided to shoot the flashback scene all handheld. And we choose a different format. We decided to shoot this in 16:9. We also were toying with 4:3, but it would have made it even sort of like 4:3, sort of more sort of 70s and 80s. So we decided to shoot it with in the 16:9, and we used Kyle Zeiss Mark II's super speeds to really keep the depth of field to absolute minimum. It was very much told from the perspective of one person, so we would stay with the main guy throughout the entire scene that in reality happens maybe in 20 minutes. It took us about, I think, 3-4 days to shoot it.
Wow.
Because it, I mean, the original idea was to shoot it all in one shot.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, the budget didn't allow for it. And we tried, and we rehearsed. We rehearsed it for a day, still with the idea of doing it in one go, but unfortunately that it just wasn't possible. So it's a series of extremely long takes now, and we're not trying to hide the cuts now. We've decided once we realize that it's not possible to do as one take, we sort of we toyed with the idea of, you know, doing hidden cuts, but decided not to, and shot this handheld.
So you've got the handheld and the beautiful old Mark IIs for the flashback. How did you contrast that? What did you use to contrast that in the present day?
What happens is that the last shot of the prequel stops, and it opens up with the same frame in the modern times, and the camera does not leave the tripod, dolly, or a slider for the entire movie. It is just this very little movement. If there's movement, it's usually just slow pans or maybe a little push in, and always motivated by the actors.
Yeah.
And in with the lenses, we went on the opposite side of the field. We went to master primes.
Wow. Yeah.
And we also, in terms of the framing, we were framing for widescreen, and I knew that we got to be...
So widescreen, you know, being 2:39?
Yes, correct. Yeah. And because I knew we were going to cut into the image, I wanted to preserve as much quality to the image as possible, so hence the master primes. I mean, we tested other lenses as well, but I decided to go for the master primes because a lot of the locations that we were shooting on would be in extremely small rooms because we shot in a fairly depressed region of Portugal on the borders with Spain, where most of the inhabitants left the town in a search of a better life. So there was mainly old people in the town that basically did not want to leave. And so, say in a small town of maybe 600 people, there was like maybe 15-20 inhabitants, and most of them were over 75 thereabouts. So it was, the advantage of it was that we could actually just point at a house and said, can we shoot here? And the mayor would come with this big, you know, a set of keys, and he would all fumble and he would open it and say, yeah, you can shoot here. And but most of the houses were, because they were built way back in the day, they were very, very, very small, low ceilings, and usually painted white inside because the windows were extremely small. So I knew that I would have to be shooting, and you know, we toyed with the idea of shooting anamorphic, but
just would have been a pain with the light.
The lighting budget was
not so much a pain, but you just wouldn't have had the flexibility.
Indeed. Also, the wider lenses that I knew that I was going to be using were, you know, so it was in the mix at the beginning, but then practicality just decided for us, and I really needed the extra stops on the master primes. And this shoot was very, very, very low budget. And Tiago said, listen, I'd love you to shoot this film, but you have to go and talk to our producer. And if he says yes,
the realities of it.
yes. So he gave me the name of the producer, so I went on IMDb to look at it, and I think it took me about a minute to scrape my chin off the floor because Paolo Branco is the Roger Corman of Europe.
Wow.
Paolo Branco has some 300 plus feature films to his name.
Wow.
The man is unbelievable. He's I would say he's about 75 years old, maybe older, maybe younger. It's really hard to say with Paolo because he's such a bohemian, long gray hair, you know, ripped jeans, and always doing something. I think he produced in the year when we shot it, I think he produced 5 other feature films.
Wow!
So he wasn't mincing any minute. He said, "Mark, this is it. You know, here's so much money. If you want to do it, it's yours." But and I was like, "I was going, oh, okay, I was it. I want to work with you, and I want to work with Tiago." So, but it meant that we had to be extremely, extremely clever with everything. And so he proposed a system that they used in Portugal quite a lot, where the grip and gaffer is one person.
Wow.
And so
I've not come across that. I've not heard of that on a film, like on a feature film.
Neither have I. This was a very new thing to me, and I was a little bit apprehensive at the beginning.
Yeah. How did it work in practice?
And he said, "Well, Mark, it's going to be like this. I'm the gaffer grip, and I'm going to have 4 assistants. Yeah.
Wow.
So if you want, they're going to be the best boys, and if you want, they're going to be the grips. So if you say, well, now we need to bring a dolly and build a, you know, 20-meter track, there's going to be 4 guys going do-do-do-do-do-do-do.
Yeah.
And if we're changing to, you know, it's going to be a lighting setup, there's going to be 4 guys or 5, including me, doing that. And I thought, okay, well, that's...
Well, I guess potentially the other great thing about that is whatever it is you need, you've got one person to call out for.
Correct. So
if you're trying to shoot fast...
It took me some time to get used to it, but and I don't know if I'd you know, voluntarily do it again, because it was you know, being used to the you know, you know that especially if you, you know, in a quick, you know, you want to turn around the scene something else with the grips and something else with the lights.
Yeah. But those things would be happening sequentially instead of at the same time.
Yes. Yeah. So pros and cons on both ends. It was interesting, but we had a very, very small lighting, you know, truck. I think my biggest light was a 4K. Wow. 4K HMI. And
so that's not a lot of firepower.
No, but, you know, we basically, a lot of it, I mean, the interior scenes, we had some, but in percentage, I would say maybe 30% of the film is interiors. Mm. And a lot of them are night interiors. So I would employ a lot of LED lights. I had light mats. Yeah. We had, the Astera bulbs that you can screw into fixtures and remote control them through your iPhone or iPad.
Yep.
When really needed, we would push in, you know, the 4K through a window if the scene called for it. But a lot of the time, we would just use interior fixtures on the shoot, on the interior scenes. Mm. We had because of the small interiors, a lot of it, we tended to shoot around, I think, 21, I would say that 21 mil was our sort of main lens, 21 to 24. Mm. I had a 14 millimeter, but it was a ultra prime.
Right.
Because the ultra prime, which was quite amazing, did not distort whatsoever in terms of the vertical lines.
Wow.
And I was looking down a stairwell and also seeing the first floor. There was lots of straight horizontal or vertical lines. And I was right back in the corner with the camera. And I was looking at the image and I was just calling to the director. I said, "This is unbelievable." And he goes, "What do you mean?" He goes, "Everything is just perfect."
Yeah,
and
wow.
So we use that 14 mil, which I would very rarely use on a normal shoot because of, you know, 14 mil being what it is.
Yeah.
But it worked just brilliantly.
Wow.
We did a lot of the scenes. Some of the scenes we would cover just in one shot. There'd be very little coverage, and sometimes I'd be offering. I said, "Tiago, we need to shoot." And he goes, no, I like it like this." I go, we only have one scene for the entire one shot for the entire scene." And he goes, "Yeah." He says, "If we shoot another one, I would tend to use it, and I don't want to do that."
Wow.
And I thought that was so ballsy.
Yeah. To be that certain of when you've got it and what you need to tell the story.
And I must say, we had stunning, stunning cast for this film. And one thing I haven't mentioned yet, that because of the nature of the script and the massive emotional, you know, journey that the actors are going through, it was decided that we shoot the entire film chronologically.
Wow, how amazing.
Which I don't think I've ever heard of, or, you know, obviously there must have been people that have done it.
I think there's a lot of people start off wanting to do it, but to actually follow through on that's pretty rare.
Basically, on a day one, we open on a page one of the script.
Wow.
And then I remember we were shooting the last page of the script. It was the last shot of the last day of the entire film. And
wow.
And obviously, you know, being a DOP, I was going, "But guys, it means that we have to come back to this location like 12 times." They go, "Yes."
Wow.
You know, our producer, because he obviously, they went through the script with the director many, many times and had, you know, discussions, approved it and said, "Okay, this is how we're going to do it. We're going to shoot this entire film chronologically." And
I guess a producer that's that experienced would know exactly what that means and know how to make that work before ever agreeing to it.
To have a producer that is capable, because I can see most producers going, "What?
Yeah, no way.
This is not happening."
Yeah.
And so having someone like him to go, "Yes, I can understand, I appreciate it, and this is how we do it."
Yeah.
So our shooting schedule was 48 days.
Wow.
The movie could have been shot much faster, of course, if we shot, you know, traditionally. But they've decided that they want to shoot chronologically, and that's what we did. And
which must have been amazing for the actors.
It basically paid off in the end because the film was selected for the Cannes Film Festival,
which is still, I think, for most independent filmmakers, it's still kind of the ultimate, isn't it?
I actually saw it when it was the editor who texted me and said, "Have you heard?" And I go, "Heard what?" And he goes, "About Cannes." And I'm going, "Well, you know, I did a bit of a sneak look, and we're not there." And he goes, "Mark, no, we've been selected for Cannes Film Festival." I go, "Oh, I don't believe you." So he sends me a link. So I click on it, it opens up, it says Cannes Film Festival, you know, official selection, and there's Restos de Vento. So I suspected him that he made a mock website just to play a practical joke on me. But
that seemed more likely.
Yeah, but within minutes, I had a call from the director and the producer, and they basically confirmed that Restos have been selected for Cannes. Wow. And so I think that was another sort of sleepless night I had. Because we could never, you know, I mean, that would not even enter your mind that you would. I mean, we knew that the film we were making was special in terms of the story and what it said. But being a fairly low budget shoot, you kind of, you know, all you want to do is just you want to make a movie that you can just be proud of, and that's it, you know. So you're not, you know, never ever.
That's a home run.
Yeah. That was quite amazing.
I mean, quite an incredible journey, you know, from the projection booth on a ship, communist ship, rolling around on the high seas to this film at the Cannes Film Festival. How does it feel kind of looking at that whole journey?
I think it didn't really hit home until, and I have not seen the film in its full, you know, fully finished, you know, way until the big cinema in Cannes. And I remember walking in with my wife, and there on the seats, it said, you know, Mark Bliss, and, you know, you got those palm leaves around it. And, yeah, you know, that's, it was unbelievable. It was honestly, it was to the feeling of, you know, yes, that little kid that used to play cowboys and Indians with his friends, you know, reenacting the Western movies, to be there. It was it's like, yeah, the dreams come through. It was unbelievable. It was extremely humbling as well, in a sense. It was really, because you there with you know, all these other filmmakers, you know, people that you've, you know, read about, or, you know, you've looked upon your entire life, and suddenly you on the red carpet next to them. And so, yeah, it was well and truly an amazing, but I must say, for me, it was a very humbling experience. It was also instilled a certain amount of peace and quiet in myself as a DOP.
That's wonderful. Well, congratulations on the success of the film. And I can't wait to see it, hopefully in a cinema here in Australia soon. And Mark, thanks for stopping in.
Not a problem. Thank you for your time, and greetings to everyone.
Thanks, Mark.